all of the best. God bless. Oh, she has been here. She's not new. I'm only introducing you because she's our staff, the support staff who has been here. Maybe Honorable Advocate Jenkins. You are graduating to be an MP very soon. Advocate Jenkins will take the opportunity to introduce all the people that are accompanying him. If there are those that I might have not acknowledged, I take a special acknowledgement because this is your first appearance before us, and we are so blessed and to have you among us. So without any waste of time, honorable members, I will allow Honorable Jenkins just to take us through key areas of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning, Honorable members, Deputy Secretary, and colleagues. In February 2013, I made this presentation that's on the board at the moment. We've had a referral from the resolution. Why I just want to put this up again for members is just to see that in the resolution itself, there is an instruction to the Standing Committee on Finance to, if it's necessary, to introduce amending legislation. And this is specifically important because it means that we do not need, as a committee, further permission from the National Assembly to introduce this legislation. One needs to report with that amending legislation, and that's a procedure in terms of a committee bill. A summary of the proposed amendments before I go to the draft bill that was prepared by our new drafting unit in legal services. There's the issue of the oversight mechanism, which has not been established in terms of the Act, and what the proposed changes there is to make the present parliamentary oversight mechanism that oversight mechanism in terms of Section 4, and just to allow the Act, amend the Act so that allowance will be made, and then certainly the rules governing the parliamentary oversight authority, or the POA as it referred to, that will have to be done in terms of the joint rules. So that's something that will happen, but this will be the first step in that direction. The second issue is the application to provincial legislatures. If I may remind members, the Constitutional Court judgment has said that provincial legislatures do not have the constitutional power to make their own financial management legislation. Either Parliament must assign that to them, or we must provide that in legislation. The political decision from the Speaker's Forum was taken to say Parliament will provide that legislation. But there's a constitutional deadline, or not a constitutional deadline, a constitutional court order that says we need to report by 9 September on how far we are with this bill. How far, what mechanisms have we put in place to what the constitutional court calls to remedy defect. The defect being that provincial legislatures do not have a regulatory framework to do their financial management. There's an amendment to Section 17, which is, I'll explain when we get to the bill, is just to make it clear how Parliament's budgetary process must work. And then certain sections in terms of the tabling of the annual report, there's a proposed amendment to make that consistent with the Public Finance Management Act. Chairperson, if it's in order, I'm not going to go through the entire PowerPoint presentation I did in February, but I'm going to go to the Act, if that's in order, Chair, and just show what we've done. Well, perhaps on this one, let me just, Chairperson, say that the amendment, which I'll show now on the screen, is simply to remove the restriction on the membership of the Parliament Oversight Authority. As the Act reads at the moment, the Speaker and the Deputy Speaker and the Chairperson and the Deputy Chairperson of the NCOP may not be members of that oversight mechanism. Now, the issue is just to loosen the membership up so that the POA can serve as that, and that the Speaker and the Chairperson might be members of it. That would be left, in any case, one, to the joint rules to decide, because the Act requires that the joint rules provide for membership issues, and secondly, the issue of a conflict of interest, because that is clear, and I spoke about it last time. The issue of a conflict of interest, the Parliament's oversight authority, or the oversight mechanism, while it's still the oversight mechanism, they will be tasked to consider and report to the Houses certain instructions, amongst them executive authority giving a financial an instruction with financial implications and whether that should be authorized or not if it was unauthorized. So clearly, you cannot have a chairperson there that has made that instruction unless that oversight authority approves of that. So it's a normal committee procedure where one will have to declare that there's a conflict of interest, and the committee will decide whether the chair must recuse themselves or not. Furthermore, of course, there's the issue of public involvement. If the BOA will operate as a joint committee, there will be public involvement, and one must keep that in mind. What is the public image of Parliament's oversight? As I said, there's the application to provincial legislatures. The Constitutional Court wants Parliament to report to it by 9 September on how we've remedied these defects. And we're including the provincial legislatures in this act now, and I'll indicate that to the committee. The adjustments budget issue, I think I will better explain that if when one looks at the bill itself. It's simply to make it clear that the draft budget of Parliament must go to the oversight mechanism, which is happening at this point in time. The draft budget of Parliament goes to the, as well as the draft strategic plan, goes to the Parliament Oversight Authority. So it's a bit of a consequential amendment also to the issue of the oversight mechanism becoming the POA, because the POA, as it stands at the moment, consider the draft strat plan and the draft budget. And the Act used to, that when it was in a bill form, included those specific provisions. And also specifically to say that your unspent funds, your own funds that were not spent, that you retain, first of all, and secondly, you get that approved. The purpose for the spending of that must be approved by the Houses. It does not have to be included in the National Adjustments Budget. The only thing that, from Parliament's side, that's included in the National Adjustments Budget is the appropriated, additional appropriated funds that the Treasury will put in the budget and submit in terms of in the bill to Parliament for approval. And that amendment will make that clear. And the tabling of the annual report, this is a little bit of a dated. We've developed this further. The main thing in the annual report issue is the workflow. And I'll show that in the bill, Chairperson. The workflow, as it stands at the moment, the Auditor General reports back to the Executive Authority on the audit report, which, according to our acting Chief Finance Officer and the Audit Committee in Parliament, has said that that is not how it actually happens. What happens is that the accounting officer receives the audit report and includes it in the annual report, and that then goes to the Executive Authority. And then the reporting lines is not consistent with the Public Finance Management Act, and one of the purposes of this bill is to have a financial management regime for Parliament that's consistent with the public sector as a whole. Chair, I'm going to go to the bill now. This is the draft bill. It was developed by our legal services. We have a drafting unit now in legal services.
They all have. Okay.
I suppose, yes, sir.
I think
I believe so. As I said, we have a new drafting unit, and I've employed them for the purpose of drafting this bill. Mr. Michael Prince assisted me with this, and I tried to get him here today. Unfortunately, he has another obligation. But should I not be available to answer questions in the future on this bill, I would brief him on it, and I would ask him to come and brief the committee on it so that... Excuse me, ma'am? No, ma'am, I'm not intending to leave, but not permanently, ma'am. I'm going to go on vacation some other time. Chairperson, the members can go through the purpose of this amendment bill. Please don't be confused with that part, that there's an amendment to the Powers and Privileges Act. It's just put in there simply because we're amending a part that amends, or that the Act already has repealed all those sections of the Powers and Privileges Act. So don't be confused with this. It's just for formal drafting requirements, if I may call it that. The first, if I can go clause by clause, so the arrangement of sections, that's just consequential to the amendments to the Act. We're just changing the sections because if I can point that out, the norms and standards for provincial legislatures, that's one of the headings in the arrangement of sections. Of course, there's no more norms and standards for provincial legislatures now. What we're going to have is going to have an application to provincial legislatures and how provincial legislatures must do their financial management. The preamble, if one goes to clause 2, we're including provincial legislatures in the purposes and in the raison d'entrée, in the reason for this bill. So that's just a consequential to the Constitutional Court case, which I referred to here. It's maybe a little bit small to read, but it's Premier of Limpopo Province versus the Speaker of the Provincial Legislature, Limpopo Provincial Legislature. We're putting in some new definitions, because we're needing to make a distinction between Parliament and provincial legislatures. So we're including a definition of Parliament, and we're including a definition of provincial legislatures, as well as a provincial annual budget, and the, to give effect to the amendments to the Act. In terms of Clause 4, the objects of the Act, what we want to amend there is simply to take out again norms and standards for provincial legislatures, because we've already said that it's going to apply now. We're going to have an application to provincial legislatures. And this is all to do with the Constitutional Court case. Here is the amendment in Clause 5 to Section 3 of the Act. We're taking out provincial legislatures must adhere to the norms and standards, and be including the application of the Act to provincial legislatures, and we're including this whole new Section 3. Now, what does Section 3, and it's a mechanism that was proposed, it's not the only mechanism, but what it does is just to say this Act remains as it is, but where we read Parliament, we must see it as a provincial legislature. Where we see a joint committee, it's a committee of the provincial legislature. When we refer to the Speaker and the Chairperson or the Executive Authority, it must be construed as a Speaker of the provincial legislature, etc., etc., etc. Annual budget must be the provincial annual budget. National treasury must be a provincial treasury. National revenue fund must be a provincial revenue fund. Provincial revenue fund is defined in the Public Finance Management Act. Sections where we refer to issues of powers of committees and so on, we refer to the section 115 of the Constitution that applies to provincial legislatures. And joint rules must read the rules of a provincial legislature made in terms of section 116 of the Constitution. So all of this amendment and the inclusion of the new section 3 is to give effect to the Constitutional Court cases, to provide a regulatory framework for provincial legislatures. Chairperson, the second proposed amendment, section 4 of the Act, what I indicated in the PowerPoint presentation, this is to make it possible that our present oversight mechanism in Parliament can also be the oversight mechanism envisaged in Section 4 of the Act. So we're taking out the restriction on the membership of that committee. The Act says at the moment, or provides at the moment, except the representation on the oversight mechanism must be in terms of the joint rules of Parliament. That part we leave. We're saying that this restriction is causing problems in establishing this committee. So we're taking that out, which says that you may not be a member of the committee if you're the Speaker, Deputy Speaker, Chairperson, or Deputy Chairperson. And we're going to organize or regulate that in terms of the joint rules, because the Act still says that the joint rules must give effect to the membership requirements. There is also Schedule 2 to the Act, which deals with the Code of Ethics for members of the Executive Authority. And issues in there that are addressed is issue of conflict of interest. So that remains to make sure that we don't have a appearance that there is not proper oversight in Parliament of Parliament's budget. Section 17, Chairperson, that is the budgeting process. Now, when one looks at Section 17 in the Act, its heading did not take into account the removal that we did at one stage. The heading of Section 17 of the Act says submission of drafts of strategic plan, annual performance plan, and budget. But then it just goes to subsection 1, and it says that the Executive Authority must, after consultation with the Minister of Finance, determine a process for introducing Parliament's budget and adjustments budget. Now that what I'm trying to indicate there is from the heading one can see something was removed, because we don't talk about a submission of drafts of the strategic plan and the annual performance plan. So the proposal coming from, I can be specific, coming from our projects office, who dealt with the whole budgeting process and the adjustments process and the workflow around that, to say, why don't we bring that back? So we're bringing back that the executive authority must table in Parliament for referral to the oversight mechanism. And as I indicated before, at this point in time, it gets referred to the Parliamentary Oversight Authority, the POA, which we're trying to merge these two bodies, so that we don't have an additional committee in Parliament, but just use the committees that are at the moment. This is submit the draft strategic plan to Parliament, and then for referral to this oversight mechanism, the draft annual performance plan, as well as the adjustments budget, and then, importantly, the draft revisions of the approved allocations of Parliament's own funds. Now, Parliament's own funds is those that we raise ourselves, either through donations or through previous years' unspent funds, becomes our own funds. Now, that we do not return to the National Revenue Fund. Parliament keeps its own funds, and it needs to approve those own funds in terms of a budget, but that budget is not the one that's included in the adjustments budget or even the next year's appropriation bill. That is, Parliament just needs to approve that and include it in its own annual performance plan and to see how we're going to use that money. But that money must be approved by the Houses. It cannot be approved simply by the executive authority or a committee of Parliament. The Houses must approve it like any other public funds must be approved by Parliament. So that's the suggestion in terms of Section 17's amendment. Chairperson, Clause 8 of the bill deals with the workflow in terms of our auditing. And Section 58 of the Act, it says there that the Auditor General must submit an audit report to the accounting officer. Now, that's inconsistent if one looks at Section 40 sub 2 of the Public Finance Management Act. Section 40 sub 2 of the Public Finance Management Act says that the Auditor General must submit the audit report to the accounting officer.
Sorry, Chair. Can I kindly ask the advocate to just to put down, because we don't have on our presentation this slide, the exact, yeah. We don't have it on our paper.
The comments you don't have.
No. The comments you don't have, yeah.
No, it doesn't have the comments. I included those last night for purpose of briefing the committee, and I thought it's better, but as you know, I can send this to Alan immediately after the meeting. Yes, my apologies. Thank you very much. Chairperson, what we're trying to do, I see the draft that refers to the accounting authority. That's the words used in the Public Finance Management Act. We make that accounting officer because that's defined in the Act. So we will work on that, but the critical issue is the workflow. The way the workflow...
No, oh, sorry.
The workflow as it happens at the moment is that the Auditor General sends management letters to our audit task team and to management, senior management of Parliament, including the Secretary to Parliament, who is the accounting officer. And once those issues have been discussed and consulted, there's an audit report that's presented, and in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, it goes to the accounting authority. In our case, it will go to the accounting officer, and it's the accounting officer's responsibility then to put that into the annual report and to give that annual report to the executive authority. And the executive authority must take the annual report and table it in the House. And in terms of the Finance Management of Parliament Act, the Houses must refer that to the oversight mechanism for report back to the House to do the oversight work. It's pretty much what a Committee on Public Accounts must do, but this is a joint committee. So we're trying to get that workflow consistent with how the workflow is happening with public service elsewhere. So all we're doing at that point is changing not to submit it from to the executive authority, but to submit it to the accounting authority. Again, here where there's a problem, let's call it a problem, if the Auditor General cannot complete that audit report, then he reports to the executive authority, but we want to include the accounting officer, because the accounting officer needs to respond to that report. So to make it a legal requirement so that the accounting officer can get that report from the auditor general indicating why. Maybe there's a lack of information to complete the audit report, or maybe there's non-compliance or a lack of assistance from certain members of Parliament administration. The critical point is the accounting officer needs to know about that as soon as possible, because he is accountable to the executive authority to submit that annual report. But we're leaving the executive authority in there simply because they have a responsibility in terms of the Act. They have a responsibility in terms of the Act to table that in the House if there is a problem with submitting the audit report, and they are accountable to the Houses finally for the financial management. Chairperson, the part we removed there, this part, the executive authority must promptly table the report in Parliament. Included a new subsection just to break it up, make it clear. The executive authority must promptly table the report referred to it in subsection 2 in Parliament. This is a consequential amendment to the one I discussed just now. Once the Auditor General has submitted an audit report to the accounting officer, not to the executive authority, no person may alter the report. So it's just the personality that's changed there. Chairperson, this is more to, it's consequential to the responsibility of the accounting officer, clause 9, and we're amending section 59 of the Act, just to say that the accounting officer must submit the annual report, and to make it clear, we know what the annual report includes, but in the PFMA, again, it's indicated separately, so we make it clear that the annual report, including the audit financial statements for that financial year and the audit reports on those statements, must be then submitted to the accounting officer. Now, the time frame comes in here, Chairperson. What the Act used to say is to say that the executive authority has now 5 days to table this in Parliament. But the timelines in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, which is substantially followed in the Finance Management of Parliament Act, is that the accounting officer has 2 months from the end of the financial year to complete the financial statement. After 2 months, he must submit that financial, he or she must submit those financial statements to the Auditor General. The Auditor General's office gets 2 months to complete an audit report and submit the audit report back to the accounting officer. So we had 4 months past the end of the financial year then. Then the Public Finance Management Act, and what we're trying to do with our Financial Management Act to make it the same, says that your executive authority must then table your annual report, including the audited financial statements and the audit report, in Parliament within 5 months of the financial year. It doesn't spell out 5 months, but it says within a month of the accounting officer receiving the audit report. So if you receive your audit report as an accounting officer within 1 month, so that's 3 months after the financial year, you still have 1 month only to submit it to the executive authority. Then the executive authority must table that. Now what our Act says at the moment is you have 5 days of the executive authority to table it. But what we're trying to do with this amendment is to make it the same as the Public Finance Management Act, to say there's two issues here. One is the accounting officer receives the audit report, he has 1 month to give it to the executive authority. But the executive authority also only has 1 month to table it. So between the executive authority and the accounting officers, they must work out when the annual report will be submitted to them, because the executive authority might want to scrutinize that annual report before tabling it, read through it, familiarize themselves with it, perhaps to make a speech or something. But what this will do is just to make it, or to bring it in line with the Public Finance Management Act, to say that once you have your audit report, you have 1 month to give it to the executive authority, and the executive authority has 1 month to table it. So between the two bodies there, the executive authority and the accounting officer, you must make sure that you have, excuse the expression, your ducks in a row so the Parliament can get this report without undue delay. The way we're trying to do that, Chairperson, will become clearer on this part. It used to say, and this is what we propose to take up, the executive authority must table the annual report, including the audit financial statements and the audit reports, within 1 month of receiving it from the accounting officer. Well, within 1 month after the accounting officer received the audit report. What the Act at this point says is, it says you must table it 5 working days of receiving it, which that they should get the normal period, the 1 month, from the day that the audit report is there. So if the Auditor General cannot provide the audit report for whatever reason to the accounting officer, that should not be a responsibility of the executive authority to report on it. That's a responsibility of the accounting officer. The accounting officer must say why and find out why there's a lack of compliance or why the Auditor General cannot finalize that. But once it's finalized, once there is an audit report, and then the 1 month starts ticking. And for that, if the executive authority cannot table, then within 1 month, for that they need to be held accountable. And this is what we're trying to do with this last section, is to say, if the executive authority does not table the annual report in accordance with section 61, and 61 is that one there which says, you must table, as the executive authority, you must table the annual report within 1 month of the auditor giving the audit report to the accounting officer. So it's trying to bring into the various probabilities or possibilities in the audit process and to actually just pin the accountability for non-compliance of that process where it belongs. And I think that discussion was not held maybe a different idea was when the Act was drafted, but this will make it consistent with the Public Finance Management Act. And in my view, it doesn't really change the lines of accountability, responsibility, or timeline. It remains the same. But the general concern I had when I went through the Act to find out whether there are issues that we need to look at, specifically time frames, because that's what the resolution of 20 September of the House requires the committee to do. This is the issue that came up for us at Legal Services when we discussed it, to say, why is this not similar to the Public Finance Management Act? And what happens if there is a problem with the audit process, and first of all, the Auditor General reports straight to the Executive Authority, but the Executive Authority, for whatever reason, is not able to inform the accounting officer of that. How is the accounting officer going to try and fulfill their function? Secondly, if there's a problem, if the problem lies with the accounting officer, why should the executive authority report to the House if they're not able to table the report within 5 days? They might not know the reason. So we're trying to bring that in line, and it's, as I say, it's of course something that the committee can discuss. I don't think I'm doing justice to all the discussions that have gone through there, but that is where we think we will solve the problem. Chairperson, that I would call it a substantial amendment. Clause 12 amends further sections of the Public Finance Management Act, trying to remove those parts out of the Public Finance Management Act that applies to provincial legislatures. I might at this juncture indicate to the committee that in amending the Public Finance Management Act, there are two requirements. First of all, you have to consult with the Minister of Finance prior to introducing an amendment to the Public Finance Management Act. And this is what happened when we drafted the Financial Management of Parliament Act. The second requirement is if you, in the Act, in your Amendment Act, specifically allows exclusion of funds to be paid into a national revenue fund or a provincial revenue fund, you need to specifically consult with the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Finance needs to approve it, saying whether it's reasonable to allow that exclusion from the national or provincial revenue fund. That we also did when we drafted the Financial Management of Parliament Act. We'll have to do it again. And there is now, through our discussions, another thing that came up that was not, I think, included in the initial draft of the Financial Management of Parliament Act, and it's this part. Section 89.4b, it should read, Chairperson, 89.1A5. Well, it says that item 5 of section 89.4b should be 1A. That's a mistake that crept in the drafting. I indicated in the comments, and I'll distribute that after the meeting. What that does, it deals with the general accepted accounting standards for applying when you draft your financial statements. And those accounting standards at this point in time is set by the Accounting Standards Board, which is a body appointed by the Minister of Finance. In terms of, or in line with your separation of powers, the Act was drafted to say that if there are no standards for accounting applicable to Parliament, then the executive authority must set those standards consistent with the standards in the public service or in other bodies, so that that consistency runs through. But the decision making about what standards must apply, although it's the same, simply we want to locate that within the executive authority, because the executive authority heads this legislative arm of government and not the Minister of Finance. So we're trying to create that separation of powers a little bit more clear when it comes to accounting and financial management. But as I indicated, when we went through the PFMA and the Financial Management of Parliament Act, that part stood out to say, should that apply to provincial legislatures or not? And should we not include there also the provision in Section 89 that says Parliament must also comply with those general accepted accounting standards? Chairperson, my suggestion there is something that we should include in the letter to the Minister of Finance to see what Treasury comes up with. They might have objections to that, and one can discuss it. But it's something that was not discussed before, if my memory serves me correct. Chairperson, that is about it. We're changing, of course, the name of the Act to include provincial legislatures. It will now be Financial Management of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures. We're repealing Schedule 1, Clause 14, because that is the norms and standards for provincial legislatures, which are, of the Constitutional Court case, basically meaningless. And then, of course, the long title of the Act we're changing. There's a memorandum. Members have the memorandum. I didn't make any comments on that. Takes us in a cryptic way through all the amendments. I think critically here would be the tagging, the classification of the legislation, which we will advise that it's a 76, simply because it's dealing with financial matters that affect provinces. In terms of the constitution, that must be a 76, and it does not deal with traditional law or customary law, so it does not have to be referred in terms of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act to the National House of Traditional Leaders for comments. So that is that act. Maybe that bill. Maybe just as a end note, I drafted yesterday a quick document on the process. How must a committee introduce a bill? What must be done for a committee bill? I think this needs to be taken into consideration also in terms of time frames. What I heard earlier, I'm not too concerned with it. If I can make a suggestion, I think the step after this would be, can we publish this bill as it is in the Government Gazette calling for public comments? That would be in terms of the rules of Parliament. If that is a decision of the committee, then one can do that, call for public hearings, if it's necessary, otherwise only written submissions can be called for. That would be a step in the process. I think simultaneously we'll have to write to the Minister of Finance indicating the amendments and the one question around the Accounting Standard Board, and see what the Minister of Finance or Treasury wants to say about that. The issue of facilitation of public participation is in that document. Have you handed it out? The issue of facilitation of public involvement, it's a constitutional obligation. It starts off by a call for comments, but if there are no comments or if the committee feels that there's no need for public hearings, the committee can decide that. However, it needs to be reasonable. So if there's a number of submissions calling for public hearings because they're very concerned about the impact of this legislation, I think the committee should consider whether it's not reasonable to have public hearings then. On the other hand, if there's one or two written submissions and people indicate that they do not want to make oral submissions, there's no obligation of the committee to have oral submissions. One needs to deal with that on a case-by-case basis, just to give effect to those constitutional amendments. And then the amendments to the PFMA, I've said something about that, Chairperson. I indicate that in the document. Thank you, Chair. That's from me. If there are any questions, thanks.
But I thank you very much, Advocate Jenkins. Honourable members, ladies, please, Honourable De Beer and Honourable Mashaba, feel free to also robust engage in this presentation. May I have questions from the members? Is there any? Honourable De Beer, Honourable Pronounce Notes, and Honourable Ross, and Honourable Mashaba.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the advocate for the work that has been done to the bill. I want to go to Section 89, Paragraph 4B, Advocate, which talks about the accounting standards. Now, where the amendments are proposing that those accounting standards rather let the executive authority to deal with them and not the Minister of Finance. Now, I am not too sure. I need a clarity. For me, accounting standards are more an operational activity. And if we remove that from the minister and we allocate it to the executive authority, how is that going to be done in the provinces should a dispute arise? How are we going to handle that? Are we not going to go back and have the same cases where we lost as government? That is the first thing. And then I just want to get this. I just want to get the reporting procedure or process practically. We as you are saying, advocate, here is an accounting officer sitting with the annual report and financial statements. He submits them to the Auditor General, whom the Auditor General is being given 2 months to deal with them. Now, after he has done it, after the Auditor General has done this within 2 months, he completes it and then he hands it over back to the accounting officer as an annual report, not to the executive authority. Wow. And now the executive authority, how he assumes that the report should be now be back to the accounting officer. Now, this is how I'm reading the amendment. He's assuming the executive authority that, yeah, the report should be there, and it is there within a month. Now, this is what I want us to clarify within the we mustn't have ambiguity within the bill, within our amendments. Because now that is setting some ambiguity, like, okay, the executive authority must assume that now the report is back, and it is within 1 month. And as you go down, it says, should the executive authority do not table in the parliament within a month. Now, can you see now, how did he know? Because now the report was not given to him. As accounting officer, he took the report to the Auditor General. It's the accounting officer that is receiving the report. But at the end of the day, the executive authority must go to the parliament and table within that time frame. That is ambiguity that I need to clarify on it. Last, Chair, with the procedure for us, the committee on the amendment bill, advocate, I agree that I'm saying thank you for giving us the proposal to work on. You are right as to what is the way forward, but I will propose, Chair, that we can hold the public hearings. There is no problem with that. You can have public hearings, but you cannot publish the bill as is. I don't know how we're going to do that. I'm saying the public hearings are there, but at the same time, I'm giving you some dilemmas there, because there are issues that we need to clarify with the Treasurer, with the Minister of Finance. One of them is the one that has just indicated on the accounting standards. Until the Minister gives us the clarity on that, as to who our task is, this. Is this an operational task or a legislative task, then we'll behave with it. Then I think that's what we need to do. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, just one question. The speaker's forum, was it unanimous?
Thank you, Chair. Just to comment, just to, in a nutshell, advocate, bringing the bill online with the BFMA, what are the outstanding issues, and perhaps just to link to Honourable Divisana's concern, with the outstanding issues that need to be referred to the minister, can we have a breakdown of those outstanding issues that we are quite certain that we are on par with the BFMA? The giving further effect to the financial management of provinces, yes, will it indeed be improved accountability? Just your comments with regards to that. You know, we've been dealing with quite substantial amendments here, appealing, deleting, and to provide matters connected. So it must have been quite a job to amend the bill to include the provinces. Just in terms of accountability, there's one question that I'd just like to ask. The transfer of duty to submit the audited financial statements, I think it falls within the ambit of the accounting officer. It sounds correct. But in terms of accountability, including the executive authority in this, is it possible to when there's perhaps a corrupt accounting officer not doing his best to submit those statements, what could the role of the executive authority be? Could it not be both having those responsibilities in terms of ultimate responsible authority? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair President. I really have a couple of these. On page, or anywhere where it appears, you know, it's because the current or the principal act talks to Parliament, and now we are adding provincial legislatures. Whether there was any difficulty of then renaming this particular bill to refer to national and provincial legislatures for purpose of it to be readable, whether that was ever considered. The second issue, it is this section on page 5, struggling into page 6. I think I've got two issues on there. Number one is that whatever it is not captured here, this is a reference of the parliamentary section to be construed referring to the provincial legislature. Whatever it is not captured here, but having a relevant section in legislature will not be construed as being also meant by the principal act for Parliament. Because we have tabled the whole list up to L. Is that list conclusive? That there is nothing outside? Because if there is something outside this list, then cannot be construed to be referring to anything in the provincial legislature. That is my question. But then to avoid that, I'm now asking whether there can't be any intelligent redrafting in one sentence that actually contain all this in one sentence, rather than listing all these things and then probably some sort of creativity of a provision that actually will mean this, so that even if in future there is an amendment on the section of Parliament, then it that one sentence will still be accommodating that in relation to provinces, rather than just writing one by one and one by one like that. And I just believe, Chair, that some intelligent people there, they can have one little paragraph that actually talks to what we're trying to do with this lengthy section here. Then number three, Chair, I really have a problem with the separation of responsibility between the accounting officer and the executive authority. I do have a serious problem with that, because what we also say is that this executive authority does not necessarily have authority over Parliament, because if it doesn't receive the necessary documentation from the accounting officer, then it just walks to Parliament hands down and just say, no, we received nothing. But it is an authority of Parliament, executive authority. In the case of a firm where you've got the board of directors and the CEO, what is the situation? Why here we try and create the CEO to be some authority? We are creating the accounting officer to be some authority. And whereas there is also the executive authority. And the executive authority, which we understand that must be totally in control of what happens in Parliament. But then it has got no power in relation to ensuring that the financial statements are submitted to the Auditor General and the annual reports are being prepared, and they demand that to happen, and then we separate. They can only wait for the accounting officer to submit this document. If the accounting officer doesn't do so, then they just simply sit and say, no, Parliament, the time has elapsed. This guy has not given us the document. And that's it. Why are we dividing this? Probably there may be a good reason, I'm not sure, but it undermines the authority, the powers of the executive authority. And then the last but one. As a Section 76 bill, is it not expected to be introduced in the LCOP? Is there anything that talks to where it should be introduced, that Section 76 should be introduced in the NA or in the LCOP? And then the last one is, I think it talks to the memorandum. There is an indication there that this bill doesn't talk to customary law or traditional communities. But I thought that it talks to legislators that are spending public money. Does the National House of Traditional Leaders not, is it not being seen as a legislator? Doesn't it spend public funds? What informs his opinion to separate it? Because surely there is financial management that's supposed to be happening in the National House of Traditional Leaders as well as the province government. And how are they managing those funds, and why these are not applicable to those as well? Thank you, Tepper.
I still want to find why they change in Section 59, because Section 59 to me, it was clearly outlining the powers between the executive and the accounting officer, so that the executive should be the one that always submits the report to Parliament, other than equating the two, because that's the
Advocate Jenkins. May we have your response?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll do my best. Very, very interesting, very challenging questions, if I may say that. And Honourable Bazana started probably with the most challenging one for me. Ma'am, this concerns the setting of a norms and standards. If I can read the provision in the Public Finance Management Act, Section 18.9, which, interestingly enough, we didn't change when we did the Financial Management of Parliament Act. Chapter 11 of the Public Finance Management Act deals with the Accounting Standards Board. It's 87, the minister establishes, etc., and then at Section 89, it then says the Accounting Standards Board must set standards of generally recognized accounting practice as required by Section 216 of the Constitution, 4, and then at Sub 5, Parliament and Provincial Legislature. Now that's there. So that's their job at the moment. They set the standards for us. We didn't change that. When we went, and if I may, Honourable Ross, just to deal with that question of outstanding issues. This was the one outstanding issue that we saw, that we needed to address. If I may say so, ma'am, and I'm saying it, and I'll put my reason up front. My reason is that the time frames have become rather tight to report back to the Constitutional Court on this legislation. So I would like to get the ball rolling, so to speak, and to publish this book. One could take it out of the book, that section, that proposed amendment. In other words, let's not amend Section 89 of the PSM. What we can do is but include it in the letter to the Minister of Finance to say we would like a comment on this, because this does seem to impact on the separation of powers. Now, the separation of powers is different from country to country. South Africa did not take up the strong separation of powers that we have in the United States of America, for instance. And that is clear if one reads the decision of the Constitutional Court in the Limpopo case, where they said, province, yes, we have separation of powers between legislature and the executive, but we're not a federation, and we don't have that strict separation of powers that Parliament cannot prescribe for province how they must do things. So that was sort of underlying a lot of the discussions and arguments within that court case. So what one can do is to take that out, but then put it to the minister to say, what does the minister think in terms of this? Because my concern by leaving it in is that how do we address the fact that Parliament, if we don't amend that, Parliament is still subject to the standard, accounting standards set by that board, but province is not. Now that to me is inconsistent, but because we're only dealing with provinces here, we looked at that aspect. And Mr. Michael Prince, who drafted this for us, indicated that, and he says, look, this is something I'm going to leave with you because you didn't ask me to deal with that part. But you need to explain it to the committee, and that's what I'm doing now. So my suggestion to get that ball rolling now, I can take it out, and I can include it in a draft letter, which I can give to Alan, and the committee can discuss whether that letter is appropriate to the minister. Just ask the minister, please comment on this specific part. We want to amend these things, which are clear. We did it before when we drafted, when we passed or introduced the Financial Management of Parliament Bill. Now we want to introduce an amendment. We're taking out the provisions of the PFMA that applies to provinces. But we've noted that here is a section where your appointees in the Accounting Standards Board are setting standards for Parliament. In your view, does it conflict with the separation of powers doctrine that's underpinning the Constitution? And if so, would it be reasonable to remove this or not? And see what the Minister has to say. Hopefully one can also pass the vote.
Chair, sorry to interrupt. No, I don't have a problem for the proposal. It's quite accurate. Thank you.
I think I've dealt with the issue of publication as well. The Section 56 of the Financial Management of Parliament Act, that's not the issue where we start dealing with the submission of the audit report to the sorry, that's the preparation of financial standards. Let me just indicate there what the Act says. It says that Parliament, the accounting officer, must prepare annual financial statements in accordance with the standards of generally recognized accounting practice. Those are the standards set by the accounting standard boards. And then it goes on, in the absence of applicable standards, then the executive authority sets it. So if one leaves out those amendments, which the Honourable Chairperson said, you know, they still have a role to play as the political heads of a legislature, if there's a gap. So let me leave it there. Thanks, ma'am. I think I've addressed that. Mr. Kornoff, was there unanimity within the speaker's forum? I suppose that means that they all agree that Parliament must provide and not assign. There were provinces who felt, I operate at that administrative level, and there were people within the administration, specifically in the Legal Advisors Forum, that's not a forum for all the legal advisors of the legislatures, who felt that it would be easier if we assigned that power. But the presentation made by the speaker at that meeting in, I think it was in Johannesburg, and the discussion that followed, there was a decision taken that it's going to be Parliament that keeps its constitutional responsibility to provide legislation. One must keep that in mind, I would say, that the Constitution, according to the Constitutional Court's interpretation thereof, said that it's Parliament's function to provide legislation for financial management, whether it's for public service at large, whether it's for government departments, public entities in the PFMA, or whether it's for provincial legislatures. Now, Parliament can't assign any of those functions to a province. The question is, why would you want to assign it if the Constitution has already said it's your job to do that? So that was the argument, as far as I recall, the speaker indicating that this is Parliament's job, this is what the Constitution wants Parliament to do. The Constitutional Court said that to us, so we're going to do it, and that decision was taken.
Does that imply that since there was a speaker's forum where provinces were represented, does that imply we must not expect any submission from provinces as we head this so public committee? Was the outcome of the speaker's forum binding to these provinces, or can we expect a submission from the province as we call for public participation or public comment?
Chairperson, I think we can expect public comments from provinces. I don't think it implies that there's going to be no comments from them. Also, being a 76 bill, they will have to mandate the NCOP to vote, or the delegations to vote in the NCOP. If I just, on that point, without labouring it, there might be provisions in here that appears financially onerous on some of the smaller legislatures, like the Northern Cape and so on. And we might get comments saying we need to keep in mind that we don't have funds to have an audit committee and an internal audit unit, etc., etc. So one must see what comes out of that. Chairperson, Mr. Ross' question, the PFMA outstanding issues, I think I've dealt with that. Will it improve accountability? I would argue yes, sir, because at the moment, provinces operate on what they call the spirit of the PFMA. They get audit reports, and they get audited by the Auditor General, but one of the functions of an audit is to see whether there's compliance with legislation. The PFMA does not apply, and it was said in the Constitutional Court case, PFMA does not apply to the financial management as a whole for provinces. Only very small parts of the PFMA applies to provinces. So there's always been an issue. How do you make a proper audit report to say you are complying or you're not complying with legislation if that regulatory framework is not there? And that's why the Constitutional Court requested Parliament to report back to it on 9 September, because they want to see how far is this regulatory framework. And one must remember that since 1999, when the PFMA has been there, there hasn't been really any regulatory framework for provinces. How do they do their financial management? Therefore, they operate in the spirit. One of the things that they've done is they've returned their unspent funds to the provincial revenue funds and so forth, which was required by their provincial treasuries. I don't know, a few provinces who have done that, but there's no reason in law, there's no provision in law that requires that, that is consistent with the Constitution. So there's a bit of an inconsistency there. So I would argue the accountability will be improved simply because it's now clear what your responsibilities are and what you are accounting for. And the Auditor General can, of course, pinpoint where that responsibility lies, and then the oversight of the houses will deal with that, or supposed to deal with that. The role of the executive authority in the issue of accountability, Chairperson, and it's an issue that's run through a few questions by saying, what we're proposing is to say that the audit report must go to the executive authority rather than the accounting officer. Now, the reason why we did that, first of all, and I indicated that, is to be consistent with the Public Finance Management Act. That's how it happens in the Public Finance Management Act. Secondly, it happens in practice like that. The Auditor General does not negotiate and have appointments with the executive authority when he's compiling his audit report. He doesn't send it to the executive authority. He gives it to the accounting officer. So we're bringing that in line. But what bothered me about the workflow, if one goes from a research point of view, it might seem frivolous, but I enjoy doing that. I go from a research point of view. I'm somewhere in whatever part of the world, and I'm doing research on Parliament's accountability, and I'm looking at Parliament, and I'm reading through this Act. Now, the Act in Section 56 then says you must prepare your financial statements, then you must submit your financial statements within 2 months to the Auditor General. That's Section 57. Then you go to Section 58, and the Auditor General must now audit the financial statements and then submit it to the Executive Authority. So let's just assume the Executive Authority is there and the Accounting Officer is there. So the Executive Authority has the audit financial statements. Then you go to Section 59, and it says the Accounting Officer must submit Parliament's annual report to the Executive Authority. But there's no provision that actually says the Executive Authority must give a copy or give the audit report to the Accounting Officer, so that the accounting officer can actually complete the annual report. So there's a gap in the legislation for me in terms of the workflow. Now the question I'm being asked is, are we not jeopardizing making the accountability less by saying the Auditor General must give it to the accounting officer and not to the executive authority? And I would argue not, simply by saying that the responsibility is still there in the Act. If one looks at the first chapter, the Act still requires that the accounting officer is responsible for implementing this Act and is accountable to the executive authority. The executive authority must have oversight over the implementation of the Act and is accountable to the houses for the financial management of Parliament. So the final responsibility still rests with them. So it's in terms of that I say that you're not diminishing, you're not jeopardizing accountability. You're rather dealing with workflow issues here. And in my argument, the Act also allows the executive authority to issue instructions and to deal with certain things. For instance, to say to the accounting officer, I want to see that audit report. I know the Auditor General has submitted it to you. I want to see it now. You're not allowed to change it. You're going to put it now in the annual report. From 1 month, you received it yesterday. 1 month from yesterday, we are supposed to table it in Parliament. We would like to read through it, so we want that annual report within 2 weeks from you. Not a month, because it's not going to give us any time to consider the annual report. So you've got your preparations, you've done your financial statements, the draft annual report should have been done long ago. I want 2 weeks, I want everything included in there. In the meantime, I want to see the audit report so that we can deal with it. The audit report, I might just remind the members, is part of the performance management of the accounting officer in terms of the Act. It might be taken into consideration when there's a performance management on the accounting officer. Furthermore, the Act also requires that the provisions in this Act forms part of the performance agreement with the accounting officer. And that's one of the reasons why I would like to get that workflow proper. Because if there's a gap, a gap allows someone to say, well, I never received the audit report. The Auditor General gave it to you. Yes, I got a copy, but it's neither here nor there. You have to formally give it to me, because in terms of the Act, you receive it. I'm just painting a picture of this friction between the accounting officer and the executive authority. But one must keep it in mind, plan for the worst, hope for the best, but in the end, the legislation needs to be amended every now and then. But
I think, ma'am, we're not creating gaps, we're filling gaps. We're not taking anything away from the executive authority in terms of that. Sheila, for that didn't quite understand the question. Now I understand it clearly that it is an issue, and this is where public service differs a little bit from the private sector. One of the aims of the Public Finance Management Act at the time in 1999 was to do that separation. To say let managers manage, and the executive authority, in other words, the political heads, oversee that management. They don't get involved with the day-to-day business of the management. For instance, they don't get involved with tender procedures, setting up the accounts. They take decisions which must be taken at the political level. And the administrative decisions get taken at the administrative level. So that's the separation that started in 1999 with the Public Finance Management Act. And that's also the reason why we try to make the Financial Management of Parliament Act consistent with that, and therefore the separation. So if one assumes, or let's say that the POA will do a lot of the functions of the oversight mechanism. There, as it is at the moment, the accounting officer is an ex officio member of the POA, as I understand its composition. But, yes, however, when that oversight mechanism is established properly in terms of the Act, I would argue to say that the POA should call the accounting officer to make presentations to it and to accounts. And to explain, much like Scopa will call a director general to come and explain. But you cannot sit there as a member and say, I'm a member of this committee and therefore I have certain rights to say or not say certain things. You will be then more of an official in front of that political structure. So that's how I see that will change as well, sir. You cannot conflate the two, simply because we're trying to create that gap.
Now, thank you, Chair. I think the advocate there is actually prompting me to speak on this matter as a specialist on it. This is a matter of public administration, where the existence of the separation of powers between the executive and the accounting officer, which is called the political administrative dichotomy, where there is a necessity of a mutual understanding or an interface between the two, the discipline and the phenomenon, the administrator or the implementer of decisions being the accounting officer, the decision maker at the political arena, which is the minister. He is clearly spelling it out to say that in line with the Public Finance Management Act, there are clear and distinct functioning between the two, the political and the administrative arm, which I think there is no contradiction or there is no problem which is created by this. And instead, this one is actually closing that gap, which would be seen maybe as a competition between the two, which is not necessary, because that interface requires the minister, requires the political head to have a mutual kind of understanding that when we are to take a decision that has the tea, or just an arrangement that says this is what we want to achieve by doing this and that. But in terms of separation of powers, the accounting officer is the one who has an authority to implement, and then the minister take a decision. So that is the executive. Yes.
You can proceed, Dr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Very fast, Norwegian.
Yeah, thank you very much for that, too. I'm grateful for that. The issues raised by Honorable Mashile, the referral to national and provincial legislatures, what we did was we would just use the name of the Constitution. The Constitution refers to Parliament on the one hand and provincial legislatures. And we kept it there. There's also a few provincial legislatures that refer to themselves as provincial parliaments, which we also, that's an issue for the province and for that specific legislature. So we're just following the constitutional wording for it, for consistency. I think your question, sir, on the, is the list conclusive, the new Section 3? It's a very, very good point. As far as we are concerned, it is, but nobody's perfect. I would suggest two things there. Is this something we can look at to say, if I understand your question correctly, isn't there a way we can craft something in there to say if there's other issues that are not included here, but it's clear from the context of the Act that it should be, then we must consider that the province can do the same, something in that line. The other point I want to make on that is it will be really interesting to see what provincial legislatures come back with, either in the public participation process here or as mandates in the NCOP, because they will have to go through it with a fine tooth comb and say, can we implement this? Do we have the budget to implement this? Do we have the resources? Do we have the human resources? Do we have the systems? How is it going to change our lives? Is there something that's been left out here because we do something unique in KwaZulu-Natal that Northern Cape is not doing, or the other way around? So I find that interesting and something that I will raise again with our drafting unit and look at it. But so far as we're concerned, it is conclusive. But I don't think we should stop at that. The issue of the separation between the accounting officer and the executive authority, I think we've dealt with that. Okay. The Section 76 legislation. So the Constitution requires legislation to be introduced in the NCOP only by a member or committee. So it can be introduced, but it doesn't have to be introduced. It shouldn't say require. The Constitution allows. Certain legislation the Constitution wants introduced in the NA, even certain 76 legislation. Not sure if this is one of these, but the point why it's here is that the resolution of the National Assembly has asked this committee to deal with it, including submitting a draft bill to the House. So that's why it's going through the NA process. I don't think there will be anything stopping this process to going through the NCOP to start there. But for that to happen, the NA will have to retract their resolution or something, and the NCOP will have to set out the resolution there. So that's why it's going through the NA process. It doesn't have to go to the NCOP.
So why are these particular points? Is that in the report you are supposed to be reporting in September to the Constitutional Court?
Yes.
You see, now September coming back to now, how many months are we having? And in the NCOP, then you have got a process of the 6-week cycle. You know, it's of public participation involving provinces. Now, in relation to this short period that you are sitting with, if you allow it to start in the National Assembly and go its time there, and then it comes now as a Section 26 to start and go through the process in the NCOP, you may not meet the September deadline. That's the main reason why I'm raising this particular matter. Why don't we short-circuit it, and then it starts from that side? Because then in the NA, it can be dealt with within a week or so. But in the NCOP, it can't happen. There is a stipulated agreed period that needs to take place for a legislation to go through. And therefore, in relation to that particular period in which you have to report to the Constitutional Court, then it will be advisable for us to be tactical in order to actually meet those particular dates.
Chairperson, yes, on the same point. Parliament resumes its work on the 22nd of July. We've got a serious challenge with legislation being referred from the NA to the NCOP in terms of time. It's being held back, and I don't know for what reason. Taking into account the six-week cycle. So the process in the NA by the Standing Committee for Finance is quite crucial to expedite that the legislation be with us on the 22nd of July in the NCOP. Otherwise, we're not going to make the time frame as captured here in the presentation.
So in terms of the legal issues here and the procedural issues, it's a consideration that the committee can take. It's a, we need to report back to the National Assembly, and one can say this bill or this draft bill should start with the NCOP, and then we don't have to try and introduce this into the NA. But it's a political decision, I think, that must be taken. And discuss the time frames and maybe see from the two secretaries to the houses what are their views in terms of time frames and procedure. But as it stands, there's a resolution that says this committee must report back. I think it would be in order for this committee to say we're reporting back, we've identified the areas that should be amended, we've put the draft bill there, which we're not necessarily want to introduce, but we want to place it for consideration, and whether the NCOP should not introduce this bill. But it's a bit in the procedural realm. I think one must speak to the secretaries of the two houses, what their views are on both the resolution and then having a report that sort of refers to the NCOP, and to see what these things can be done. But the time frame issue is a real issue for me, because it's a constitutional court that gave Parliament an order. It is something that we need in terms of cooperative government and the three spheres of government working together and respect for each other need to take serious. But as we are doing at this point in time, one must report the work to the constitutional court. If the bill is not ready at that time, one needs to report that to say where we are, what we're going to do, and what the implications are. So I'll leave it at that, sir.
Just about to check, because I was trying to check the instruction of the Constitutional Court. Are we expected to report on progress or to report on a finalization of this whole thing? Because that's what I wanted to check. So if we are the respect that we are doing, I don't think there's any offense in reporting our progress. But I'm not sure the details. I'm trying to look at the instructions from the Constitutional Court. But anyway, you might assist me to clarify that. Honorable Korngoff?
Chairperson, no, I want to concur with you. I think it's just a progress report. It's not that we have finalized the legislation. If we cannot, because of time frames, it's simply not possible. But we have to report by the 9th of September exactly what we have done. There is progress here, make no mistake. By the 9th, I think we would have been able to put in a very good report for the Constitutional Court.
So take on that, Dr. Chenis.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The Constitutional Court order says that the parties, that's for all the parties and the provincial legislatures, including the provincial legislatures and the MECs, are ordered to file a report by Monday, 9 September, informing the court what steps have been taken to remedy the defect. So it sounds on one hand that it's a progress report, but it's not pursuant to validity of the other provincial legislation, which was suspended for 18 months. So after that 18 months, those legislations or those regulatory frameworks in the provinces will all fall away. So the court might say, well, you're reporting progress on the steps you've taken, but now our order has expired. There's nothing that the provinces can rely on. Those provinces, they can issue a new order. I'm not sure if they're going to take kindly to it, if I may quite frank and candid about it. They would say, you've given you 18 months to do this. So I think the first prize is to have the bill finalized and sent to the president for assent. The president was not a party to the court, so he doesn't have to report anything. But to have the bill finalized, and if we can report to the court to say, bill is finalized, it's sent to the president for assent, I think that's the first prize.
Standing touching the advice that we are getting from honourable members from the NCOP, that aspect of maybe circumventing this whole prolonged or protracted process by starting this matter with the NCOP and bring it back to you. And you said you can check with the secretary as to how can this be realized. I don't think we have a problem. I don't think the committee have a problem with that. As long as it will ensure that, we comply to this instruction. So I think the committee can apply its responsibility on this. You know. Let's hear what you advise.
Chair, what I'll do, I'll speak to the two secretaries of the houses and to see what their views are and report back to the committee. I can speak directly to Alan on a daily basis and he can report back if that's in order. And the critical issue is time frames, I think. Okay. Chairperson, I think there's two more questions that remained. The one is the National House of Traditional Leaders. The Honourable Mashilo, that provision in the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, there's a provision there that says any bill affecting traditional law or customs of traditional communities must be referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders for comment. They must be there for at least, at the most 30 days. They have 30 days to comment on that. Before Parliament passes, before the first house in which that bill was introduced passes that bill. Now, all we're saying is that this piece of legislation, this amendment bill, doesn't affect customs of traditional communities, doesn't affect traditional law, therefore we do not have to refer it there. I mean, that would be another 30 days waiting for the comments to come in. Well, it can happen simultaneously when we're doing other work on the bill, but it's not necessary in terms of law to do that. It certainly does not imply that the National House of Traditional Leaders itself shouldn't be subject to oversight and accounting for the public funds they use. I think that is there, it is covered. They are an organ of state. They have to submit to Parliament their finance and so on. So I think it's two separate issues. It's just that this bill doesn't have to go to them for comment. Nothing stops them from commenting, but there's not a legal obligation on Parliament to refer it there. So that legal obligation is quite specific. It says the Secretary of Parliament must refer it there. Formally, usually it's noted in the ATC, the announcement tabling, the committee reports, and then we wait for 30 days for that comment to come back before the committee finalizes its work. But it's not necessary in this case. But it doesn't speak to the accountability or the financial issues of the National House at all. It doesn't deal with that. It's a separate issue altogether.
But say, the matter that I was raising, the matter I was raising, when it talks to any processing of any piece of legislation, there is that specific issue that if you are not dealing with customary law or whatever, then you don't need to refer it to them. But now we're dealing with a piece of legislation that talks to management of finances of legislatures. Because now when we have incorporated the provinces, it's of legislatures. Now the question, of course, is that why the very same principles that the Act that we are dealing with, that we are now want to extend to provincial legislatures, cannot be applicable to the National House of Traditional Leaders House as a legislature. That's the question I'm raising.
Yeah, I want to understand from Commissioner through you, Chair. Is he saying? Honorable. I am so sorry. I want to understand. Is he saying this amendment? Does it affect them? Because as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't.
All what I'm saying.
Let's do it through the chair. Maybe you can just clarify the question.
Chair, I'm saying that we had a piece of legislation that actually governs the management of funds in Parliament. And then now we are actually extending this to provincial legislature. Yes, but we are extending the cover.
Let it be done through the chair. No, continue.
Yes, we are.
If you are not clear, then to come back again.
My understanding is that now we are extending this now to cover even provincial legislature, that we are governed by the same piece of legislation on the management of the public funds. Now I'm saying, why it cannot also cover the National House of traditional leaders as a legislature? That's the question I'm asking.
I think the question is straightforward. Maybe let's get a response from Advocate Chair.
Thank you, sir. No, I understand the question. Well, it's a policy issue. I mean, should Parliament want to include them, then we can. I mean, the question that we'll have to deal with then is, do we need separate legislation for them? I can go look at the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act. I'm sure it's set out in there to say this is your responsibility, this is how you must account. That might be there already. I would find it very strange that if it's not there, if there are no regulations applying to that body, that how they must account for public funds. But this piece of legislation doesn't deal with them. Nothing stops Parliament from saying, I want to deal with it, in whichever way.
What I would advise us to consider, because I think that question says, why don't we get something that will be applicable to all stakeholders in this particular sector? So now the advocate is saying, you go and check if there's any specific provision for this particular sector. And obviously, there's no provision. I think he might also advise if there are prospects for us to link what we are doing now with the House of Traditional Leaders, So, and I think it will help us even to avoid us having to come back and then redo this process specifically for this sector, Because the rest of the matter is that they are allocated, they also get allocation as part of the stakeholder in the legislation, a legislative sector, So I think that allows us then an opportunity, or maybe allows the court advocate changes an opportunity just to make sure that that area is also tight, and saving time and also making sure that we have a piece of legislation that will apply to all. And I don't think there's any harm in that, And I will give that another hint of that.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, I just wanted to remind the members that what was said by the Constitutional Court, it referred this amendment based on the provincial matter of Limpopo. So basically, I do understand what you're saying, that we mustn't come back, but at the same time, we mustn't broaden the legislation to a point where we will end up having dispute because we're broadening it. Let us look at it based on the content of what has been said by the Constitutional Court. Thank you.
Correct. We will allow, because we are still at the stage where we are just being taken through some of these necessary amendments. So if after establishing that there is a need for us to look into that area, we will do that, and obviously all of us will have a final say on the final product before we take it back to the House. So I think all the submissions are accommodated. Is there any other issue that you still need to address at the agendas?
Honorable Mthethwa's question on Section 59, Amendment to 59 of the Financial Management of Parliament Act. All we're trying to do there, as I indicate in the comments, bring that it just doesn't give this scope to the accounting officer. But when I read it now, sir, the accounting officer must submit the annual report of Parliament or Parliament's annual report. But I think this part, let me highlight it so the committee can see what I'm talking about. Here we unpack what the annual report must include, the audit financial statements of that financial year and the audit report on those statements, to the executive authority. We're taking out so that the executive authority is able to table the report in Parliament within 5 months. I think as it stands, it's unproblematic, and we don't actually want to change that. They must still be able to submit the report within 5 months. But what the PFMA says, because it takes into consideration that there might be an issue with the auditing process, and the Auditor General might take longer than 2 months to submit it to the accounting officer. So the reason why we're changing it is simply to then, and we see it more in Section 60, to say, not that you are able to submit it within 5 months, but you must be able to submit it within 1 month of receiving, of the accounting officer receiving that audit report. So that it might not be 5 months then. It might be longer. Because the accounting officer had an issue to deal with between himself or herself and the accounting. But we still maintain that it should be 1 month. So all things happening according to plan, it's still 5 months. And the issue of that discussion between the executive authority and the accounting officer is still there. One cannot do away with that. Nothing stops the executive authority to say, look, I need to submit that report. Everything is fine. Give me the annual report and as it is within the next 2 weeks so that I can look at it within the next 2 weeks and table it in Parliament. That is still there, but we're just trying to get that workflow again so that it's not 5 months, and if you can't do it in 5 months, you need to explain to the houses why not. In any case, that accountability to the houses, if you cannot submit the audit, the annual report within 5 months, that is in any case there. The Act still requires the Auditor General to submit a report to the houses then, as well as the Executive Authority to say why is it not there? Well, what is the problem? But you're not going to hold the Executive Authority accountable for a mistake or a issue that's being dealt with between the accounting officer and the Auditor General, and then saying, but you can't submit it within 5 months. But it comes out when you look at Section 60. Because there we say you must submit that within 1 month of the accounting officer receiving the report. And that's the wording that basically uses the Public Finance Management Act. So I think I've dealt with all the questions on that matter.
Mainly aspect of alignment.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, all right. I think for now, members, all our current sitting questions have been addressed. Now we need to then entertain the proposals that have been presented to us in as far as the workflow, or maybe how do we take this particular assignment forward. And now there are two scenarios that I think we need to do this under. The first scenario is a scenario where the advice that the advocate is going to seek from the Secretariat comes out to say, no, we need to do what we have been doing without referring it to the NCOP. That's the first scenario. The second scenario, it might be that the one that says, let's refer everything to NCOP and then they'll come back to us at the later stage. So that simply says, that might affect everything here. So obviously, I'll want us, I mean, to resolve on the first scenario as if, I mean, we haven't received the final advice. Just to make sure that if the advice comes, or it comes out saying that we must proceed as we have been doing, then we know that we have agreed on some of these things. And then the fact is that we need to agree on is the one of the public hearings, because the proposed date here is the 22nd of July. But remember, there was that particular concern of the National Treasury a take on the accounting standards. And I think there was an advice that can be taken out. That's how we resolve it. So I'm not sure if there's any disagreement on us considering public hearings on the 22nd of July. Are we agreed? Honorable members?
Chair, I've seen the outline proposal, but I was of the view that if we communicate it back to the chair and the chair advise Advocate Junkin, what we do as a study group, we go through it now, since we've just been given now, go through it and the chairperson will communicate that directly to the with the other grouping as well, be given a chance to go and fill up whatever they think about it.
Honorable,
Chairperson, throwing a stone in the bush. A third scenario, why can't we do this exercise jointly?
So, if you suggest joint, then it implies jointly with us. Let's get to know.
Advocate is going to consult with the two secretaries in Supri and the one in the NA.
Correct.
Put that question on the table as well. Why can't we do the work jointly? And when we do public hearings, call the provinces. They are used to coming to Cape Town as far as where we are concerned with our work in the NCP. We call them regularly. So. Well, that's a question that Advocate Jenkins will have to clear out with the leadership.
I just want to compliment that week is a difficult week for me, but don't worry about that. I will definitely not be here on the 22nd of July. But my concern is it really necessary for public hearings? This is straightforward. It was an oversight. It was an original oversight. It came out in a constitutional court. We just rectify. Why should we waste money on public hearings?
I think according to the advice that has been received from Advocate Jenkins, if we take the matter for public, advertising for public comment, and then there are people who insist, a number of people who insist that they want to make oral submission, so we can make a determination of going for public hearings, but nothing stops us. I'm not sure of our test processes on the NCOP. Because I know at times you are like compared to take it through the party, you know. So maybe that might change this whole thing. Okay.
Well, Chair, although is that just recognizing what Comrade De Beer has just said, is that Honorable De Beer, yes. The challenge still is we can only finalize it when it has been formally referred to the NCOP. We can have public hearings, but until it is referred to the NCOP, there is very little we can do about it. Now, just because it has been taken to be Section 76, then it activates the NCOP as well as provincial legislatures in terms of all those mandating the powers legislation. And therefore, we can avoid the public hearing ourselves from the NCOP. That's the problem, and it's the one that is very lengthy. You can shorten it in the National Assembly. I think you can find a way of shortening it to almost a week or so. But in the NCOP, you're not going to be able to shorten it because it has to go through the province. That's merely being Section 76. That's why the advice that we're trying to make that why don't we consider introducing it in the NCOP? Then it may be much, much more shorter and easier in relation to this reporting time. And I think what Mr. Jenkins has indicated, you know, in terms of responding to the Constitutional Court, it is a completion of the legislation that amounts to remedying the situation. Just the report that says, no, we are reviewing the legislation, it doesn't remedy the situation that activated that court ruling. So we need by September to have actually concluded the process and the houses having agreed and accepted the piece of legislation.
So in a nutshell, there is no disagreement around the fact that I think the key thing that we need to establish through them is how do you bring the two houses together so as we have a final product as expected, you know. So that simply says we are leaving everything to you to finalize and come back to us as an indication of how we're going to do this jointly, you know. By the time the deadlines, I think that they are in order. And the provision for study group is always there. I mean, as you remember, it was introduced at the study group level some time ago. It will still go back to other study groups, I mean, for further information. You know. So it will always be there. It will always be there. Okay. I think that's how we wrap it, and we'll keep close contact with the Office of the Advocate to make sure that we don't miss on this deadline. And committees will be obviously duly informed of the progress going forward. You know. Okay, members, thanks very much. I mean, that brings us to the end of our meeting. This meeting is officially adjourned. Okay.